from the NBC newsroom in New York. President Roosevelt said in a statement today that the Japanese have attacked the Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, from the air. I'll repeat that. President Roosevelt says that the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii from the air. This bulletin came to you from the NBC newsroom in New York,
which for 2 years has been at war with Adolf Hitler. To the battlefronts of the world, this neighbor at war has sent men, food, airplanes, guns, and ships. 13 months ago, President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Mackenzie King agreed to merge the Canadian and American defense efforts through a joint defense production committee. And 8 months ago, additional committees began to plan defense, to control materials, and to integrate the war and defense efforts of the two nations. What has been Canada's effort in the war thus far? How is inflation controlled? What about labor? What lessons can the United States learn from Canada? To bring to you and other intelligent alert citizens the answers to these and related questions, the roundtable opens its New York microphones to three observers who will discuss Canada, a neighbor at war, a discussion that represents the individual views of the participants and in no way represents the views of any agency or government. Participating are George Britnell, economic advisor to the Wartime Prizes and Trade Board, the Dominion of Canada, and professor of economics at the University of Saskatchewan, John McCormack, author and Canadian correspondent of the New York Times, and Neil H. Jacoby, professor of finance at the University of Chicago, at present on leave to the National Bureau of Economic Research. Mr. Jacoby.
When Canada is mentioned, I suspect that Americans most frequently think of two things, the Dion quintuplets and the scarlet-coated Royal Canadian Mounted Police, whose pictures we Americans so often admire. But I wonder whether these very colorful elements of Canadian life are the important things today, McCormick.
No, Jacoby, I don't think they really are the most important things. I think Americans should realize that Canada is both a problem and an opportunity for the United States, as well as a great playground, of course. The problem is that the United States is to protect Canada for her own security. But the opportunity is in the fact that Canada is a member of what President Roosevelt called the Sisterhood of the British Empire. And that through Canada, a very friendly country, the United States can, to a considerable extent, align the policies of that empire with her own. Don't you agree, Britnell?
Well, no doubt, McCormick. Canada can be looked upon by the United States as a laboratory in which certain experiments are taking place in an economy which has definitely streamlined itself for war.
You know, one thing that has interested me a great deal, Britnell, is that Canada got into this war as a result of an independent political decision. The question of war came to a vote of Parliament, and the people of Canada, through their Parliament, voted to get into it.
Yes, Canada is certainly at war by her own free choice. The Prime Minister of Canada called a special session of Parliament 4 days after the British and French declarations of war on Germany at the beginning of September 1939. After a full-fledged debate, the Canadian Parliament did vote itself, almost unanimously, in favor of participation. Therefore, on September the 10th, the King, at the specific request of the Canadian government, declared that a state of war existed between Canada and Germany. As one Canadian summed it up the other day, King George VI of England did not ask us to declare war for him. We asked King George VI of Canada to declare war for us.
That's quite a different picture than most Americans have in mind regarding the entry of Canada into the war. And I can't help but feel that it compares favorably with our own congressional activity in that regard. Very few of the questions involving our steps into the war or in the defense effort have been presented to Congress for vote before they occur.
You think it's better, Jacoby, to declare war rather than merely to fight it?
I think it's better to have the elected representatives of the people make a decision beforehand. I like that Canadian procedure.
There's a great deal of criticism, I may say, in Canada at even the week's delay that ensued.
Well, that may be. But in any event, Canada has got a real interest in this war, arising from the fact that about 40% of Canadian production is exported. Would you say, Britnell, as a Canadian, that Canada's economic interest in the war exceeds that, or is equal to that of any other parts of the British Empire?
I don't know that it would be greater than the economic interest of Australia or New Zealand, but it certainly is great. And we depend, I'm speaking of Canada, Canada depends a great deal on the export market to sell her raw materials particularly.
Well, perhaps we can account for Canada's decision to get into it then to a real economic interest. The fact that she depends as much as any other country upon the maintenance of world free trade, for which the British Empire has always been a great bulwark.
I think that's true, Jacoby. I think we should now discuss what Canada's war effort has been. We hear a lot about it here. We hear a lot for it and a lot against it. I think we should decide just what it has been. We have Mr. Britnell here, an authority very lately come to tell us.
What percent of your national income, Britnell, in Canada is being currently devoted to war?
About 40% at the present time.
Well, that compares with 18% in the United States. How about next year?
Well, at the present rate, it seems unlikely that 40% will suffice for next year. It's much more likely to be close to 50%, I should think, although I have seen no definite figures.
That compares with about 25% of our national income devoted to war next year, so that it would seem that your effort in Canada is now about twice as intense and will be next year, as is our own.
Well, of course, Canada started, didn't it?
Yes, Canada has about a 9-month lead on this problem of the war and defense over us. In terms of enlisted men, Canada has sent overseas an expeditionary force, and they also have many men under arms at home. What are the facts there, Rittle?
Well, the number of men Canada has enlisted for service anywhere in the world in the Army, Navy, and Air Force exceeds 360,000. If you take Canada's population as being 11.5 million, say, and the United States as being about 130 million, this would be equivalent to an overseas military force of rather more than 4 million in American terms.
That can well compare with the maximum effort we made in the First World War.
Can we say an overseas military force?
That's the total.
Active service force. That is the total, isn't it? I mean, the overseas force would be somewhat smaller.
Yes. Canadians already overseas exceed 150,000, equivalent, say, to an American expeditionary force of a little over 1.5 million.
Well, Britnell, that has been achieved, too, without conscription for overseas service. Every Canadian that goes across the oceans is doing so voluntarily. Why hasn't conscription for overseas service been imposed in Canada?
That, of course, is a question that has some political significance, and many reasons would be advanced for it. Speaking as a rather cold-blooded economist, I'm inclined to think that so far there hasn't been much necessity for conscription. We have only a limited pool of manpower available for military service, for industry, and for agriculture.
What's wrong with the woman power, Canada? Let's know.
Well, we're mobilizing that very rapidly. We have a woman's army now. We also are taking large numbers of women into the factories and have been for a considerable period.
Your point is that conscription for overseas service or the sending even on a voluntary...
We interrupt this program to take you to the NBC newsroom.
Thanks. From the NBC newsroom in New York. The White House also reported today an simultaneous air attack on Army and Navy bases in Manila. This report followed the president's declaration that all Army and Navy bases on the island of Oahu in Hawaii are now under air attack. This bulletin came to you from the NBC newsroom in New York.
Now back to our regularly scheduled program.
Canada can hardly stand up. We'll then have to have conscription of only for the sake of uniformity.
Yes, it'll be hard to conscript Americans overseas if Canadians are not also being conscripted. But what about this Canadian lend-lease program? I understand that Canada, apart from her own expeditionary force for which she is paying, is lending and leasing tremendous quantities of food and equipment to Great Britain.
Yes, she has, in the present year, sent some $22.5 billion in United States terms. Britain pays for only a fraction of these exports. In short, Canada leased lend supplies to Britain of about $900 million for the current year.
That would be about the equivalent, of, as you say, of somewhere between 15 and 16, and is against that she is getting largely unusable sterling credits in London. Am I right, Whitney?
Yes. Well, as we discussed this subject of Canada, neighbor at war, on the University of Chicago roundtable, it seems that we ought to make another point, and that is that Canada is not borrowing from the United States. She's paying for this machinery and equipment she's getting from this country in cash.
She pays cash for that.
So that Canada is not a participant in the American lease-lend program, although she has one of her own, by which she is aiding Britain.
Some materials come into Canada from the United States for use in materials to be shipped later to Britain.
Britnell, does Canada's effort compare with that of Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and the other British dominions favorably?
Some comparisons of this nature are always very difficult and subject to criticism. But I was rather surprised to see some months ago, I must say I haven't seen any recent figures, that in terms of national income, a study of the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London showed that the proportion of Canada's national income being devoted to war was rather larger than any of the other British dominions.
And we agree also, Britnell and Sokovia, too, that comparisons of this nature are not only difficult, but odious in circumstances.
Precisely. What makes them odious, McCormick?
I think that it must be admitted that the British dominions, if Canada is still a dominion, their position is now slightly different, are, if not now, in the short time, will be doing their very utmost. Their resources are already strained almost to the limit, and I think soon we'll reach that limit.
Yes, but the point is that Canada has gone farther along that path of converting her resources to the imperial war effort than have the other dominions. That, to me, is a very striking
fact. To be fair to Australia, the positions are very different.
The Canadian natural resources and Canadian industrial plant is perhaps considerably more easily geared for war, as Mr. McCormick, I think, implies.
Well, I'm implying also that Canada's fortunate in having next door a great pool of skill, a great pool of resources, of organization. In other words, the United States.
Exactly.
Very true. Canada has not been able to create this tremendous war effort without surrendering some of the liberties that traditionally have belonged to Canadians. I understand, Britnell, that you have suspended trial by jury and what the lawyers call habeas corpus, and that you now permit your policemen to go around and pick up people who were engaged in activities considered bad for the defense effort and put them in jail without trial. Is that a fact?
I suppose it is a fact, but I don't think there are a great number of people in Canada who are concerned with that. In the case of the mayor of Montreal, for instance, the mayor of Montreal, who is the most notorious case so far, undoubtedly broke the law by urging his fellow Canadians not to register after the law had been passed.
And I think we must admit that the mayor of Montreal, in any case, is a very special case. If one had to be in an internment camp, I think one would like to be in with Camillia. But at the same time, one would quite understand why Camillia himself was there.
Well, but you have also, apart from Mr. Poove, the mayor of Montreal, put into detention camps, as you rather nicely call these concentration camps of yours, certain communist labor leaders, I believe.
Shall we say that the government has said that they are communist labor leaders?
Yes, the jury hasn't even decided that they are communists.
How about it, Bethnal?
I know a good many labor leaders in Canada. I know a good many labor leaders of your CIO in Canada. I don't know any of those who are in jail.
Well, at least, Bertineau, we know that they let you out of Canada to come down to broadcast on the University of Chicago roundtable, and I can testify from looking at you that you haven't got the pallor of a concentration camp on your cheek. But there is this question, whether civil liberties that have been removed will be restored after the war is over.
Well, we have the experience of the last war to go by. There was very considerable abridgment of certain political and civil liberties in the last war. They were restored easily, one might almost say automatically for the most part, very shortly after the war ended.
Yes, I understand that Canada went so far as to take away the right to vote from a rather substantial fraction of the population that had been naturalized after, I think it was 1908. because it felt that if those people voted, they might vote against the policies then being pursued. Yet that right was restored shortly after the war, was it not?
Yes, that's the situation.
When I was in Western Canada about a month ago, I talked to a great many people. Air pilots in training, procurement officers, businessmen. And I was surprised to find the extent to which they were agreed in favor of the Canadian war effort. Western Canadians have been Canadian nationalists in the past, and many of them none too much in favor of the imperial tie with the empire. But I find that they're very much in favor of the extending all aid in the effort.
One should let Britnell answer this because he's a Westerner. It is a fact, undoubtedly, however, that the Canadian farmer, particularly the prairie farmer, has realized that his only market is the British market. He still has that. If he hadn't it, he would be completely on the dole. And that undoubtedly has changed his opinion. On the other hand, there's been a somewhat corollary change of opinion in the East, slightly in the other direction. Eastern Canada is far more friendly to the United States than she was before.
Yeah.
Even Toronto, the great home of what is called imperialist sentiment, is now very well disposed towards the United States, as I found even a year ago when I was advocating in some speeches there closer to American-Canadian relations.
Which shows that even the best of us are susceptible to economic influences.
Right.
True. But you have, Britnell, a very important problem of unity in Canada, the French-Canadian problem. One-third of your population is of French descent. What issues is that raising now for the government of Canada?
Well, the record of French Canada, I think, probably speaks for itself. The first voice raised in the Dominion in favor of the draft, as we have it, was by a French Canadian in Parliament. And the first editorial comment came from two French language newspaper.
And might I interrupt you, Britnell, and take it a little farther back? The first speech in the Canadian Parliament, I heard it myself, which pointed out that when Britain was at war, Canada could not remain neutral, was made by the late Ernest Lapointe, who died just a week ago.
Yes.
The French Canadian, the leader of Quebec.
I heard that speech myself.
While we're discussing Canada, neighbor at war, a good many of us Americans' attentions will be focused on the problem of price control. You just put into effect last Monday a new price control law, which goes much farther than anything that we have adopted in this country, despite the fact that Congress here has been wrestling with price control for some time.
Yes, we put on, in Canada, a general ceiling on prices. The Canadians decided that a price ceiling was the quickest measure to apply. They also decided that to fix all prices at once seemed more just, since, after all, one man's prices are another man's cost. Or as Tai Lung said a long time ago, one man's floor is another man's ceiling.
You know, your Prime Minister, Mackenzie King, made a very intelligent statement of the problem of price control. Perhaps I might add facetiously, because he's a graduate of our own University of Chicago. He said this: it is obvious that the prices of finished goods cannot be controlled successfully unless the cost of production is also controlled. Wages are a large element in the cost of producing the manufactured goods required by consumers. That is why the cost of living cannot be controlled unless wages are also stabilized. Now, the trick that you were able to work in Canada was to get the farmers and the labor unions to agree to wage and agricultural price control. How did you do it?
Well, labor has agreed to the cost of living bonus as a method. There are certain difficulties in agriculture, but the outstanding difficulty comes, of course, with wheat, because with respect to most other agricultural products, prices have pulled up very satisfactorily since the beginning of the war.
How high was the stratosphere of prices before you put a ceiling over it?
The increase in prices, in retail prices, in the cost of living, showed an increase of about 14-15% since the beginning of the war.
Well, that's hardly a stratosphere at all. I imagine that is no greater, if as great as the increase here. How
well,
about it, Jacoby?
Well, the trouble is, McCormick, that price rises, as I think Britnell will agree, are like snowballs. The increase is small at first, but as the price grows higher, the rise becomes faster.
The point I want to bring out is that Canada has been at war for 2 years and has still had only a 14% increase in the cost of living. That's not bad, I think.
Yes, but what concerned Canada was not so much the increase in the cost of living as the rate of increase in the cost of living over the last 6 or 7 months, which was equal to the rate in the preceding 20 months. And it was obvious that having reached a position of relatively full employment for both manpower and natural resources and plant, that we could only hope to divert larger quantities of our production to the war effort by adopting a rather drastic policy to curb inflation.
You count down on the retailer, don't you?
The first principle of the policy is, of course, that the retail price ceiling must be maintained. But I don't think it's completely accurate to say that we've clamped down on the retailer. Because if the retailer is badly caught, then manufacturers, wholesalers, and distributors will have to help in making adjustments so that the squeeze will be distributed as equitably as possible.
Rick, now, while you were talking, I've just learned that the Japanese are now bombing Burma. This is an act that may lead the United States to war against Japan. It may lead Canada to more active military effort against Japan. I merely mention this to show how fast events are moving while we're discussing these adjustments that are being made in the Canadian and American economies during the war. But to pursue this question of price control further, you have in Canada a compulsory cooling-off period in case strikes are threatened in defense plants. How has that worked? Have you found that the amount of time lost through strikes has been materially cut down?
I have no statistics with me on that point. But I don't think there is any great concern in Canada over the problem of maintaining our industries at work if not all of the time.
There has certainly been nothing, I think, personal, that you could compare to the recent epidemic of strikes here. There's nothing so sensational, so widespread, or so acute.
Perhaps that's because you have seen some more skillful statesmanship on the part of both labor leaders and business management than we have had. But some other things you've done in Canada, it seems to me, have lessons for we Americans. You have inaugurated a campaign to sell war savings certificates to the public. I think you went to all the bankers, didn't you, and asked them to tell local committees of citizens how much war savings certificates each citizen could buy out of his bank deposits.
I hadn't heard that, but I do know that there are hundreds of thousands of Canadians with very modest incomes today who are putting aside a surprisingly large part of their income each week or each month to buy war savings.
What about taxes? For a take a $1,600 income supporting a man and wife, what tax would that family have to pay in Canada now?
Well, in Canada now, he would pay $71.
And he pays only $2 or $3 or $4 in the United States.
$6, I believe.
$6.
Okay.
About the $3,000 income. What is your tax?
About $3,000. The income tax for the United States, I believe, is $138.
That's
in
right.
Canada, it would be $355. Canada has had to go where the money is. That is, to the lower and middle income tax brackets. And all through the income tax brackets of the middle class, you will find that we in Canada are taking roughly two and a half times as much as you in the United States.
And I imagine that is what accounts for the fact that you're planning this year to pay for about three-quarters of all your war expenditure out of taxes instead of loans. Our plans in the United States initially were to pay for two-thirds of the defense program out of taxes, but if Senator George's recent statement that we have enough taxes and there will be no new taxes goes into effect, it means that we will not currently pay for the war to the same extent.
Don't forget there's an election coming next November.
Perhaps that accounts for the statement at this time. But
I don't think, as one who has something to do with the Treasury from time to time, I don't think the Secretary Morgenthau, who's a very persistent man, has given up all idea of taxation on a scale, something like that at the moment.
McCormick, there's a broader question in this subject of Canada, neighbor at war. And that is the question of what the war is doing to Canadian-American relations. In your book, Canada, America's Problem, you had a good deal to say about that. You said, I think, that Canada should be an interpreter between Britain and the United States.
Yes, I said that, and I mean it. Now, we've all agreed, we've all heard statistics that show that Canada's war effort has been extremely substantial. And yet we, two of us here know, Mr. Bricknell may not, that Canada's war record has been used as an argument, not by the interventionists, but by the isolationists. It was one of the more prominent arguments in the dying days of discussions in East Manville. Now, that East Manville, in my opinion, determined the relations, defined the relations in an economic sense between the British Empire and the United States for some time to come. And it is extremely difficult to understand that Canada, whose war record we agree has been good, should be cited as a country which was not doing its best. I think the blame lies partly on the shoulders of the Canadian government, which had an awfully good case, which refused to make it until the East Manville had been passed.
Well, Britnell, that's a charge at your government. What have you to say on
before
that?
Might I interrupt for one moment before Britnell answers it? I would like to say that, in my opinion, it's the Canadian government, at least its present prime minister, is determined that Canada shall speak here only with their own voice and shall not use their influence for the British Empire as a whole.
Of course, in everything in this, as in everything else which I've said this afternoon, I speak only as a private citizen of Canada. And it does seem clear to me that Canada is not a world power in the same sense as the United States and Great Britain are world powers. And I'm not quite sure how far Canada and Canadians are competent to go in this difficult business of interpreting Great Britain to the United States or the United States to Great Britain.
Well, however that may be, Britnell, I think we can agree that Americans have a good deal to learn from Canada's war experience. We can learn that the cost of living cannot be controlled without fixing wages and farm prices as well as industrial prices. Americans can learn that a compulsory cooling-off period before strikes is a useful method of preventing slowdowns and shutdowns in defense work. Finally, Americans can learn that an all-out defense effort does not fasten dictatorship permanently on a free people, even though it does entail temporary curtailment of civil liberties. Canada is, as we have all agreed here, making a tremendous contribution to the war effort of the British Empire. Yet, whether that war is won or lost, Canada's economic and political future is inevitably bound more closely to that of the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to University of Chicago Roundtable discussion of Canada, a neighbor at war. Participating in the informal discussion were George Britnell, economic advisor to the Wartime Prices and Trade Board, the Dominion of Canada, and professor of economics at the University of Saskatchewan, John McCormack, author and Canadian correspondent of the New York Times, and Neil H. Jacoby, professor of finance at the University of Chicago, at present on leave to the National Bureau of Economic Research. In this discussion, the participants spoke for themselves and in no way represent the views of any agency or government. Thousands of intelligent Americans who want to keep up to date on the meaning and significance of world events purchase a copy of the Roundtable's printed transcript each week. Single copies are 10 cents. For $1, the transcript will be sent to you for the next 26 weeks. Please address your transcript orders and any comments you may have about today's roundtable to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago, Illinois. We invite you to be with us again next Sunday at the same time over the same station for an especially timely and important roundtable discussion, Civil Rights and Public Danger. The roundtable came to you today from the NBC studios in Radio City, New York, and is a public service feature of NBC. This is the National Broadcasting Company.